And good morning again. For the record, this is the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The date is June 27th, 2019. You may have noticed we have six matters on our calendar today. Three of those matters will be argued orally, and it appears to me as though counsel for our first case are here and ready. And so I'll ask the marshal to call the first case. All right, and just a few remarks. Counsel for appellant, if you'd like to, you can take the podium while I'm speaking, and it's really just to put everyone at ease and know a couple of things. First of all, I ask you, before you begin your remarks, to identify yourself and the client that you represent, and then as you proceed with your remarks, actually before you start them, if you want to make adjustments to the podium, please take the opportunity to do that, either the microphone or the podium height itself. There's a button there. And then keep your eye on the time. It tends to go fairly quickly. In our court, we do look forward to the conversation we're going to have with counsel today. So, counsel for appellant, if you're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Stephanie Engelkar. I represent appellants Nobles County and Sheriff Kent Welkening. May it please the court, counsel. The temporary injunction should be reversed based on two primary legal errors. First, the continued brief detention of an individual otherwise subject to release based on an outstanding warrant is not a new arrest, and it is not an unreasonable seizure under the Fourth Amendment or Minnesota Constitution when it's done for the purpose of transferring custody to ICE and, frankly, any other agency with a pending warrant. Second, the additional error of law is that the district court erred in finding that it was not consistent with Minnesota statutes and therefore ultra vires. The court didn't specifically use the term ultra vires, but that is the essence and one of the claims in the complaint here. So there are really two paths of analysis that this court needs to address. Because the unreasonable seizure analysis is separate from an ultra vires analysis. And first of all, with regard to the unreasonable seizure analysis, this court should look to Lopez versus County of Allegan. That is a federal case out of Michigan that directly addressed this issue of whether it's an unreasonable seizure.
What about the Parada case, though, in the Eighth Circuit? It seemed like that maybe came to a different conclusion.
That is a distinguishable here, Your Honor. The Parada case involves a police officer for the city of Coon Rapids that on his own initiated a detention. There was no request by ICE. This is important because the Supreme Court has indicated in Arizona versus United States that there needs to be the request from ICE paired with the probable cause, which would be provided by a warrant.
Didn't ICE change their procedures in light of some litigation, though? They used to rely solely on the detainer and then later added this warrant requirement.
Yes, Your Honor. In April 2017, there was, and I don't know if the court is thinking of the Oriana case that preceded that change. Parada had to do with a police officer continuing a detention of an individual involved in a car accident. Oriana was a case against Nobles County that involved just the sole reliance on the detainer form alone. And courts have found that just relying on the request was not permissible. The Lopez case takes the policy change of pairing it with the warrant and also reconciles that with the Supreme Court's analysis in Arizona versus United States to explain what's different. And what we have is if it was only acting under the detainer, that's not permissible. If it's only acting under the warrant, that's not permissible, because the agency cannot take their own action. When I say the agency, I mean the local agency. They can't act on their own. They have to act under a request from ICE. So the pairing is the request and then the probable cause, the necessary probable cause, which is provided by the warrant. So that's the distinction here, is now this what is being looked at is the pairing of those. So the cases that only address the detainer alone aren't on point because they're not addressing the combined use of the warrant. Lopez-Lopez addresses the use of both of those, looking at the unreasonable seizure context. It's also important to note that
Let me just interrupt you quickly on Lopez-Lopez. So the argument that I see your opponent raising is that Lopez-Lopez is not a decision that has reasoned through whether there is state authority for a state official to hold for ICE.
Yes,
now,
that's...
Do you feel otherwise, that the case does, in fact, hold for that proposition?
No, I don't. That's okay. Correct. Right. The parties in that case actually waived that issue because they didn't brief it. So Lopez-Lopez did not address the state law issue. Nonetheless, it's important for this court to analyze under the Fourth Amendment and the unreasonable seizure issue because the Fourth Amendment and the Minnesota Constitution seizure provision are identical. It's important
But it's our general inclination, and we're not alone in this. Most appellate courts view issues this way, that we will attempt to resolve an issue that the parties present on, say, statutory grounds before we would reach a constitutional issue, if we're able to do so. And obviously that was influential to the district court, and it's been, you know, a fundamental premise of your opponent, that this is a situation where state officials lack state law authority to do what they are doing. So would you address the state law issue?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, we disagree that there is no state, that there's no statutory authority for this. Section 387.03 addresses very broad in general terms the powers of a sheriff and a county sheriff in dealing with this. And specifically, the language...
So you think the best authority is... I'm sorry, I've just missed it.
Section 387.03. And first of all, I won't quote the entire statute for the court, but as the court looks at that statute, precepts are also interpreted to be warrants. This is not giving the sheriff the authority to execute an ICE warrant on his own. So to be clear, we are not advocating that the county can go execute an ICE warrant on its own. As I indicated earlier, there needs to be a pairing of the request from ICE, the warrant, and
as I understand your position, you're contending that the sheriff is effectively executing or giving respect to, in some way, the order for detention that they're receiving from ICE.
Yes, that's correct.
In light of, again, this combination approach that ICE is taking.
Correct, Your Honor.
And is that what you think 387.03 gives the sheriff authority to do?
Well, paired with the federal statute that authorizes
cooperation.
So again, the sheriff cannot execute an arrest.
Right.
ICE's arrest.
Clear. You're telling me that the sheriff cannot execute an ICE warrant for arrest. Is that right? And the warrant doesn't purport to give the sheriff that authority.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Correct.
And again, that's a position that your opponent has also taken. So you agree on that.
Yeah, the sheriff cannot on his own take an action under an ICE warrant.
Is that because no one in Nobles County is falls within the definition of an immigration officer? I mean, do you agree that no one has been certified?
Correct. Under this record, there's no one that's been certified under the 287G agreement to be a certified immigration officer.
What state law basis other than 387.03 would support their continued detention or arrest of this person?
Well, there's the cooperation with ICE under the ICE warrant and the request to continue detaining, like any other outstanding warrant. So when a jail is about to release an individual and they check for outstanding warrants, if there's an outstanding warrant from another agency and that agency makes the request to temporarily hold that individual for them to be picked up, the state of Minnesota, in the amicus brief, as well as respondents, have conceded that's okay, that's permissible. The dispute seems to be that they say it's okay because a judge has signed that warrant. But the United States Supreme Court has held that the ICE warrants are valid regardless of whether they're signed by a judge.
Right, they're valid because the Attorney General has statutory authority. Right?
Correct.
I mean, isn't that the analysis
Correct.
Of the U.S.
So
Supreme Court?
The sheriff is in a position looking at facially valid warrants. And there is no authority in Minnesota to indicate otherwise that the sheriff cannot rely on that facially valid warrant to temporarily hold that individual to allow ICE to take that individual and process them. And the record shows that the named plaintiffs in this case, that in fact happened, that ICE took them physically, processed them with fingerprinting, discussed their individual cases with them. So the actions that are comparative to an actual arrest happening are done by ICE. This is really just a continuation of the seizure that's the underlying seizure of the state charges when they are remaining at the jail. And there's nothing that indicates that the failure to immediately release an individual is an unreasonable seizure and is not permitted. In fact, that has been rejected by the Eighth Circuit.
How long can the county hold
someone? 48 hours.
48 hours? And that's based on the language of the order for detainer? Is that right?
Well, it's also based on the language of the Code of Federal Regulations.
Right. I assume it came from the,
yes,
the regulatory code.
So
your position for the four named plaintiffs is that none of them were held longer than 48 hours before ICE effectuated and processed and executed their warrant?
Yes.
Okay.
And
the record will hold you up on that?
Yes, the record would support that, and it should be set forth in the brief. There is a dispute in the record regarding the date of a warrant for Ms. Pineda. There are two different warrants that are in the record, but she was picked up within 48 hours by ICE. The difference would be on the
weekend. And I understand that there are federal regulations that define, you know, the term of the ICE hold. But again, you know, our focus in this case, based on the issues raised in the complaint that the named plaintiffs have filed and that the issue in front of the district court, again, has to do with statutory authority. When I read Minnesota statutes, I see that, in fact, the legislature has authorized certain cooperative activities by the counties, the jails, the prisons with regard to immigration officials, things such as identifying individuals who may have immigration status, and another is reporting on release. Those are the two things that jumped out at me based on the briefing of the party. So where in Minnesota statutes has the legislature authorized a county jail to hold someone for this 48 period, which, as you said, is clearly in federal regulations, but where has the state authorized the county jails to do that?
There's not an explicit statute that contains that language. And the court is correct that the statutes that you are referencing actually mandate that reporting regarding an individual status.
Well, without the explicit authority under statute, how do we come to the conclusion then that this district court judge abused his discretion?
Again, going under the two paths. So first of all, there are some, the legal analysis does need to be corrected in terms of the underlying premise here that it's an unreasonable seizure and that it's an arrest by the county. This is not an arrest by the county. That's a continuation of the underlying detention to allow ICE's arrest. It's a custodial transfer.
Where is there statutory authority for the custodial transfer?
There are very few statutes in Minnesota addressing a sheriff's powers, and 387.03 that addresses the powers and duties of a sheriff admittedly are do not address everything that a sheriff does day to day.
And do not address custodial transfers.
Correct.
Okay.
Well,
you understand our position. We are an error-correcting court.
Right.
And this is an interesting case to appear in front of us because it is on a temporary restraining order. And under the Dahlberg analysis, we are merely looking at the likelihood of success on the merits. We are not making an ultimate determination. Right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, in light of that, 387.03 not making reference to custodial transfer, and that's your bottom line position, is that this is a custodial transfer. We don't need to go to an arrest analysis, and yet you can't give me any statutory authority for the Nobles County Jail to, in fact, do this custodial transfer on behalf of ICE.
This statute is what's most on point. There's very few cases that are analyzing the statute, but one of them that does indicated that the sheriff could not go behind a facially valid warrant to question the authority of the magistrate that had signed it.
A facially valid criminal warrant under state law? Is that the case you're talking about?
Yes, I mean, it was. It's not a federal warrant.
It's a different scenario, is it?
Yes, that's correct. And it makes sense that there's not that there aren't extensive state statutes that are set forth regarding immigration powers, because it is the federal government that retains that exclusive power. Again, Nobles County is not arguing that it has immigration enforcement powers. This is really simply a cooperation and honoring what it viewed as a facially valid warrant. This is a case of first impression in Minnesota, and while this court is an error-correcting court, we urge the court to look at the legal analysis. This guidance would be provided not only to Nobles County, but also to other counties in this state.
Wouldn't one remedy be for the government to agree to a 287G agreement with Nobles County? Wouldn't that solve this issue?
Yes, Your Honor, that would solve this issue, and it's probably, candidly, more able to be achieved rather than the legislature passing an explicit statute on this. And I see my time is up. I'll address more in the rebuttal. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Norman Penilovich for respondents Rodrigo Esparza and others similarly situated. As the court noted, this appeal presents a narrow issue, whether the district court erred in finding that respondents are likely to succeed on the merits of their claims. And as the county just conceded, the court did not err because, as the county just conceded, there's no Minnesota law that expressly gives law enforcement officers the authority to arrest someone for a civil immigration violation. The county and the United States have raised primarily...
Well, I think what I heard opposing counsel to say is just that there is no Minnesota law that authorizes Noble County to do this, what they're describing as a custodial transfer. And I appreciate that your briefing has said, let's just talk about it as an arrest. But that's not their position.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that the county is taking the position that this is not an arrest. They've referred to it as a custodial transfer. Every court that has evaluated the issue of whether an I-247 and an I-200 lead to an arrest has concluded that it does, in fact, lead to a seizure and arrest. This would be the only court in the country that has evaluated this issue to find that it is not an arrest, and we would submit that...
Even your own briefing says, I mean, this is a state law issue, so it wouldn't be that unusual for our analysis of our own state law to be different from the analysis of the state law of another appellate court, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
To the extent you found another state law decision that looks at statutes very similar to Minnesota's, I'd be happy to have you point me in that direction. But the fact that you've mounted a series of decisions that have looked at different laws and reached different conclusions doesn't necessarily help the court.
Your Honor, I believe the decisions in the Lund case and the Wells case out of New York and the Lund case, Massachusetts, they did have a statutory scheme similar to Minnesota in the circumstances of arrest. Also, the reason.
And what I understand your opponent to argue on those cases is that they did not look at this sort of trifecta that we have in this case. We have the arrest warrant, we have the detainer request, and we have the order for detention. We also have the housing contract where Nobles County, in fact, tell me if I'm wrong, if an ICE agent was there to execute the warrant when our four named plaintiffs were released from their state custody, Noble County would have been perfectly within its statutory authority to then receive them under the housing contract on behalf of ICE. Isn't that right?
I do understand the county to be arguing that those documents create some sort of authority to arrest. And under the IGSA that you're referring to, if an ICE agent brings someone to the jail already in ICE custody, then the jail can house that person under that housing contract and be paid for it.
Right, and you don't dispute if that had been the scenario for the four named plaintiffs, we wouldn't be here today.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. That is a contract that they've entered into, and when somebody's in ICE custody, they can be transferred. So yes, I agree with that.
You're really focused on when Nobles County is holding an individual so that they can then be transferred to
ICE. Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And as to the issue of the combination of documents, my opposing counsel mentioned that the ICE policy changed in April of 2017 to now require an I-200 document along with a I-247. But as the court noted, that still doesn't supply any sort of state law authority to do anything. And in fact, the Lund decision, the Wells decision, and the recent Cisneros decision out of Colorado all addressed the combination of the I-247 and the I-200 document. And the Lund case, they all noted that that doesn't change the analysis because the I-200 administrative document, by its very authorizing regulations, is not it cannot be used by a state law enforcement officer to keep somebody in jail. The regulation that's relevant there is 8 CFR 287.5. So there is no combination of federal documents that provides state law authority to do something. That would that simply doesn't exist. I understood that the county also seems to be suggesting that Minnesota Statute 387.03, which is the powers and duties of the sheriff, conveys some sort of broad overarching authority to a sheriff from which this court should derive a principle that the sheriff can execute an I-200 document. Again, the I-200 document by its regulations can't be executed by an officer.
Your opponent argued today that she is not, the county is not contending that the sheriff executes the ICE warrant.
And for that reason, we believe that their claim, that their defense here fails, because then there is no authority to hold someone on any basis. They are relying.
Well, let's talk about the analogy that the county has relied on. So the ICE immigration holds are not the only type of holds that happen in county court, in county jails, and specifically in Noble County. So they also hold individuals on county warrants. So what's the statutory authority for Noble County to hold someone on a county warrant?
That could be come from the 387.11, but I would note that the distinguishing characteristic there is that a state, the state holding somebody on a warrant from another county, that's a warrant issued by a judicial officer, and it's for a crime. There is no dispute here that civil immigration violations are just that, civil. And in all circumstances here that we're discussing, the warrants that the county is referring to are in the context of criminal conduct or that are issued by judges of a court of Minnesota. So these are the fact that the I-200 document is called a warrant, I think, is a little unfortunate because it's not a warrant in the context of Minnesota law. It is, as the court noted.
Well, it's not a criminal warrant under Minnesota law, right? And we don't appear to have a Minnesota statute that recognizes this type of a civil warrant. We do have a bunch of several other types of civil warrants, but not that recognizes a civil immigration warrant.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and I think that's the point. The Minnesota legislature has set out a detailed warrant and arrest scheme in a variety of areas, both in the civil commitment realm and in the criminal realm. And the principle of statute.
On the other hand, we do have federal statutes that do authorize exactly this type of civil immigration warrant.
They do, Your Honor, when executed by a federal law enforcement officer. But in the civil immigration context, this is what Arizona versus the United States, the Supreme Court decision, was talking about. ICE, the federal government has the exclusive jurisdiction to enforce federal immigration law. So there is no state law, there's no Minnesota state law providing a state law enforcement officer with the authority to execute, to arrest anyone for a civil immigration violation. But where the legislature has spoken clearly and set out a detailed and comprehensive scheme of arrest and warrant authorities, where it has chosen to omit something, that will not be deemed to have been inadvertent, it will be deemed to be intentional. So to the extent that the Minnesota legislature had the ability to create federal and state cooperation, they could have done so if chosen not to. And in fact, Minnesota Statute 631.50 is an example of the Minnesota legislature providing express authorization for a state law enforcement officer to cooperate with ICE. It says, you will, when you take somebody into custody who you believe may not be a citizen, you communicate with ICE. This is an example of where we have, the state has authorized federal local cooperation. And again, the fact that they have not done so in the context of civil immigration detentions should be interpreted as an express denial of that right to state law enforcement officers. I also heard my opposing counsel mention that 8 USC 1357 G10B somehow provides some authority to carry out the arrest. But that is simply a preemption savings clause. And I think that a case out of the Fifth Circuit that the county and the United States rely on heavily really put best why G10B does not provide the authority they say. This is the City of El Cenizo case. And it said, and I'll quote it, Federal law regulates how local entities may cooperate in immigration enforcement, but state law specifies whether they cooperate. G10B does not itself provide any grant of authority for the state to do anything. It describes how you could cooperate, meaning to the extent that a state law enforcement officer already had authority to do anything to cooperate with ICE, like 631.50, like I just mentioned, you can still do so and you're not preempted. But to the extent that you did not have that authorization, it cannot convey any new authority. This can also be determined by examining 1357 G1 through 9. G1 through 9 lays out a detailed statutory scheme under which a state law enforcement officer can enter into an agreement with the federal government to be trained and supervised by the Attorney General, and that entire scheme would be rendered superfluous if the broad, overarching understanding of G10B were adopted, and it said that, and the county's position was adopted, saying, regardless of that entire scheme of control, you can do whatever you want to cooperate. Also, 387.03, which was discussed earlier, that is the powers and duties of the sheriff. And I note that that appears in Minnesota in Chapter 387 of the Minnesota statutes. That is an entire chapter dedicated to the sheriff. And there are other controls in that in Chapter 387, including a section called prohibitions. So the first sentence of the powers and duties says the sheriff shall keep and preserve the peace of the county. But the remainder of Chapter 387 details what that means. So it's not a broad, overarching grant of authority to the sheriff to do anything they think they need to do to keep and preserve the peace of the county. It instead describes the general responsibilities of the sheriff, and then those are limited and described and defined by other statutes of Minnesota. So none of the, as counsel conceded, there are no express statutes in Minnesota providing authority to arrest someone for a civil immigration violation. I note that there are a few other statutes that have been raised or points that have been raised by the United States in particular, and I want to focus on one, which is 626.76. This is a statute that permits the government, an agency, to enter into an agreement with another agency. But again, I think this highlights the fact that while Minnesota has created a scheme in which state officers could enter into agreements, first, that statute is limited by its express, by its subdivisions, particularly subdivision 4, which says it does not enlarge, but entering into such an agreement, like a 287G agreement, does not enlarge the powers and duties of the officer using that agreement. So it would be our position that to enter into a 287G agreement, there would still need to be state authorization for the individual conduct that would take place within that agreement, because while a Minnesota officer or an agency could enter into an agreement with the federal government, there still needs to be authorization for the conduct that they would undertake.
So in other words, Mr. Penelovich, you're saying my suggestion to Ms. Engelker at the end is to a remedy is not possible without legislation.
That's right, Your Honor. This Minnesota legislature would still need to authorize a state law enforcement officer to do the things that they would enter into an agreement to do.
So let's talk about that in the context of the housing agreement that Noble County has already providing. Is there a separate statute authorizing the county to enter into that agreement?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but I believe this would be the...
It's obviously not in front of the court. I'm just trying to understand the scope of your argument.
Right, Your Honor. I believe that this statute would be the kind of statutory authorization to enter into that kind of agreement. It's an agreement with another agency that gives the authority of the... that's what 626.76 authorizes, to enter into an agreement. There was a factual point I did want to address.
Enter into an agreement, but if I understand your argument, it still wouldn't allow Nobles County to provide the housing services unless the legislature had... That's your position, again.
And
right?
Yes, Your Honor. And Minnesota Statute 387.11, which is the jail statute, does provide that the jail can keep within it people who are lawfully committed thereto. 387.11 is actually a statute that's relied on by the county and the United States and has actually been used in a variety of other litigation to try and erect some kind of arrest authority, and it does not. What it says is the jail...
Well, again, just for a second, entertain me, if you would, and instead of focusing on arrest, because it sounds to me as though this court doesn't need to reach the arrest question. We just need to decide whether Nobles County has authority under Minnesota statute to hold an individual. And you're telling me that 387.11 does give a county jail the authority to hold someone who has been lawfully committed, obviously committed for something, correct?
Lawfully committed, Your Honor, yes, that's correct. I would point out it does not expand that authority, but somebody lawfully committed thereto, like somebody brought by ICE to the jail, already in ICE custody and under an IGSA contract, could be lawfully committed thereto. I would point out as a factual matter, I believe there is a dispute regarding how long people are held, but whether it's 48 hours or not. Maria de Pineda was ordered released on February 15th. She paid her bond on the 17th, and ICE did not come to get her until February 20th. So people are being held longer than the 48 hours. But even beyond that, Timoteo Martin Morales, who's one of our class representatives, was denied the opportunity to pay his bail because he attempted to pay bail and was told that if he did not pay if he paid his bail, he'd still be held on the ICE hold. And
I assume these are issues that, to the extent that you have asserted them, they will be handled on the merits in the court below.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to understand whether they even bear direct relevance to the issue in front of us.
Your Honor, the only way in which they bear relevance is the assertion by the county that somebody has not been held longer than 48 hours.
Assertion.
Right, that's
okay.
Right, Your Honor.
I understand.
I just wanted to point out
that
Mr. Morales then did not pay his bond because he was told he would not be released and was held for months in addition in jail on criminal custody, but because he was told he would not be released. I would also like to address the United States raised issues regarding the common law. And in short, there's no historical precedent for Minnesota ever holding somebody on conducting an arrest for a civil immigration violation. So to the extent that the court has already is already looking at the statutory scheme, there is no common law authority in Minnesota. The United States has been able to point to no case finding a common law authority to do this, and the court should not interpret now, should not create the first example of the state finding a authority to arrest someone for a civil immigration violation. Because Minnesota does not have an express statutory authorization for a state law enforcement officer to arrest anybody, we maintain the district court did not err, and this court should affirm the district court's judgment and order and maintain the temporary injunction and restraining order. And I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, if you choose, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'm frankly a little alarmed about the broad stroke painted regarding how the legislature has to dictate every single thing that a sheriff's office has authority to do. If there's a 287G agreement that's put in place, first of all, there's authority for municipalities to enter into contracts and joint powers agreements with other governments. I don't have a specific site for the court because that wasn't an issue that was briefed or really
Well, I don't think that issue's addressed. In front of us, is it, counsel?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Because we don't have a 287G agreement.
Correct.
Right.
But I just want to hit that issue because ultimately that would then result in federal law applying rather than state statutes. In terms of 387.11, with counsel's admission that gives the county jail authority to hold any individual that's brought before it, here, as this court recognized, there's not only the detainer form, the arrest warrant form from ICE, but there are also orders to detain. And as the record shows, the county jail has honored those orders to detain, and it has also honored an order to release that it's received for one of the plaintiffs. As the record indicates, one of the plaintiffs posted bail with ICE, which would not be triggered other than having the detainer and arrest form and also being taken into custody by ICE. So that individual posted bond with ICE, Mr. Martin Morales, then would have been subject to release. And in fact, the record shows had an order for release from ICE. So again, then the county jail is honoring the order for release. So both of those are orders that it is obeying from ICE. Then, and the record shows then that individual was rearrested under refiled state law charges. But the point is that order to detain or the order to release is a separate form that the jail is also looking at with the detainer form and the arrest warrant form. The record also shows that it had received those forms prior to resolution of the state charges. So those were on file on these for plaintiffs.
Right, and I don't hear a disagreement from your opponent on the chronology of events and the paperwork for these individuals. Maybe some slight disagreements here and there, but nothing along the lines of what you're describing. The question is the county's authority to hold someone on that paperwork.
And that again would be our argument is 387.03, and specifically the line about that the sheriff shall also pursue and apprehend all felons, execute all processes, writs, precepts, and orders issued or made by lawful authority,
well,
and to the sheriff
delivered.
Well, it's
curious to rely on that statute because it says execute a precept, which I think you said earlier would include a warrant, and yet you're telling me that the sheriff does not execute an ICE warrant.
And so this is where the federal and state law division makes a difference here. Under the state statute, it would seem to read that it is actually authorizing the sheriff to execute that. However, federal law does not permit the sheriff to be the one to execute that. So, which the Supreme Court has already decided in Arizona versus United States.
I hope you understand why it's difficult to follow your thinking, because the federal law doesn't authorize it, and yet you're looking at a state law that does authorize execution of warrants or precepts. Then where does that leave the Noble County Sheriff? Doesn't have state authority, doesn't have federal authority.
But the court doesn't need to address that question because the county is not executing arrest warrants for ICE.
It's a continued. To me, your argument sounds very circular, counsel, and I'm just having a hard time following it because you seem to be relying on the validity of the warrant under federal law and yet saying, but the sheriff can't act on it.
There's nothing in Minnesota law saying that it's an invalid warrant. Respondents cite to the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, but Rule 1 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure clearly indicate it only applies to state warrants. So that doesn't give any guidance.
And I think their argument is that it's not a valid criminal warrant.
Because it's not a criminal warrant. Yes, it's a civil warrant. I see my time is up, but respectfully we request that the court find that it is permitted under 387.03 and that it is not an unreasonable seizure by the county, and that the court reverse the temporary injunction.
Thank you, counsel. So our thanks to counsel. The matter was well briefed, well argued. We very much appreciated the participation of the amici in this case. The briefs were very helpful. So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So thank you.
Do you want your
So as counsel for the second matter on our calendar enter the courtroom, feel free to take a seat at the table. Take a few moments to let this happen. And as you're settling in, counsel, I'll just have the marshal call the second case. That's just to keep our record flowing. So, marshal, you can go right ahead.
Case 819.